Luke chapter 8 from verse 40. Now when Jesus returned, a crowd welcomed him, for they were all expecting him. Then a man named Jairus, a synagogue leader, came and fell at Jesus' feet, pleading with him to come to his house, because his only daughter, a girl of about 12, was dying. As Jesus was on his way, the crowds almost crushed him, and a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years, but no one could heal her. She came up behind him and touched the edge of his cloak, and immediately her bleeding stopped. "Who touched me?" Jesus asked. When they all denied it, Peter said, "Master, the people are crowding and pressing against you." But Jesus said, "Someone touched me. I know that power has gone out from me." Then the woman, seeing that she could not go unnoticed, came trembling and fell at his feet. In the presence of all the people, she told why she had touched him and how she had been instantly healed. Then he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace." While Jesus was still speaking, someone came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue leader. "Your daughter is dead," he said. "Don't bother the teacher anymore." Hearing this, Jesus said to Jairus, "Don't be afraid. Just believe, and she will be healed." When he arrived at the house of Jairus, he did not let anyone go with him except Peter, John, and James, and the child's father and mother. Meanwhile, all the people were wailing and mourning for her. "Stop wailing," Jesus said. "She is not dead, but asleep." They laughed at him, knowing that she was dead. But he took her by the hand and said, "My child, get up." Her spirit returned, and at once she stood up. Then Jesus told them to give her something to eat. Her parents were astonished, but he ordered them not to tell anyone what had happened. Amen. Christmas provides an opportunity for all sorts of things, and it certainly provides an opportunity on a church level where I get to observe a crowd, because during the season we have some crowds, which is lovely. We get lots of people come through the door, and there's a number of things that you can notice when you observe a crowd on any level, because you, and I think I'm talking to most people here this morning, respond and react in a very different way to a lot of our visitors and guests. On a number of occasions over the season, there were opportunities where you came in and your first thought was, well, where should I sit? Is my normal seat free? I think is part of where some of you came from. The second thought was, where shall I sit? How far back can I get away with? Perhaps third, what's that person doing in my seat? Fourth, do I have to go upstairs? Whereas a visitor that comes in responds very differently, and it astounds me and delights me every single time in that the visitors almost always walk straight to the front. Now, it fascinates me because I want to know what you know that they don't. Because why is it bad for you to sit just here? What do you think I'm going to do to you? Are you feeling threatened this morning, Jane? Because you are feeling threatened. So, you know, you two managed to sit here all of the time. Do you feel threatened? No. Not particularly. No, you'd be in my way. It would disturb us all if you were sat on the front row. But isn't it fascinating how crowds respond and where you choose to? An even more fascinating place. Have you ever been to a Christian event as a group? Now that is fascinating. If you walk, I can remember this vividly, and it could have gone on for a long time. We went to the Baptist Assembly when I got my handshake, and there was a group of us. There was, 10 something people like this, and we walked into the hall together, the big church, Kingsway Church at Peterborough, and there was a lot of choice in terms of where to seat. There was some banked seating right at the back. There was some widespread seating. There was side, middle, front, back. And honestly, the sense of where are we going to sit? Because there were those of us, the enthusiastic ones. I don't know why I'm looking over there, Leslie. The enthusiastic ones who were like, let's get right in the middle. We want to be right in the middle of the action. There were other those that think, no, we need an end. I'm not going to say why they need an end, but they just need an end because they need an end. There are those that didn't want to be, because again, the front is threatening, that those that didn't want to be, and they just want, just at the back of the section. Back of the section's fine, just not the front of the section. Okay. I wondered whether we needed to pray about this before we went in. That was how far it was going. And there was I remember standing there for a whole number of minutes with a great debate as to exactly where, as a group, because we all had different ideas. So where do you stand in a crowd? And why have you sat where you're sat this morning? Is it because you always sit there? Is that your seat? What would happen if you sat somewhere else next week? What would happen? I just like stirring the pot. Because you're all going to come in next week and go, is he going to notice if I just sit in my same seat? But there's an interesting dynamic about a crowd. There are interesting choices that we make when we enter into a crowd. It's much different if you were at a concert. If I was a famous rock musician, I couldn't even think of one there because half of you probably wouldn't know who it was if I said. The theology of it, the choices that you made would be much different, wouldn't they? Isn't the thought that if I was somebody who was particularly famous and you were my biggest fan, if Anna was my biggest fan as a rock musician, she would be right at the front. And she might have even chosen this morning to queue or to camp outside because she wanted to be as near as physically possible to me. I'm not saying that's why she sat on the front row now. But there's a big difference, isn't there? Because there's that thought that the closer you are, the better the experience is. Never mind that the sound that you get at the front is usually terrible. But there's a thought, I want to be as close to you as possible. Where you stand actually is significant, isn't it? What strikes me first out of this interaction in Luke's gospel is that crowd. I get that Jesus pulled a crowd in tow a lot of places that he went, but what is it that they wanted? I was thinking about the other members of the crowd first before I thought about the various people that we're told about. What is it that they wanted? I sat thinking and wondering whether actually there were other people that were desperate. Was there something that other people within that crowd just couldn't say? Was there some unknown deep place that they knew that they needed fixing but just couldn't say it? Or was there more that happened in that crowd? Was it just fandom? Was it just that hyperactive sense that here is something that's going on? Were they just wanting to watch? Because there wasn't a promise of anything originally in this, that the crowd, in a sense, gathers around Jesus as he arrives back from healing the man and putting the demons in the pigs. That's the story. He's been across the lake, been across the sea. So what were they expecting, first of all? Is it miracle time? Is that what they're hoping for? Or is it that they're desperate? Do they just want to see? Are they genuine disciples? Are they just genuinely in love with Jesus in that spiritual way? Are they just his? Have they seen him work? They're convicted and convinced. Is it that? What do they want? Whatever it is that they want, there's a dynamic to the crowd, isn't it? We're told and given the picture that Jesus is absolutely mugged and crowded. He's surrounded. They're absolutely in his face. I'm assuming that the disciples were there ushering him through the crowd like he was on the red carpet. Perhaps they'd heard the stories. What did Jairus do to get to the front? Was he just important enough as one of the synagogue officials? Was he the one that, just because he was a bit pompous, had a bit of clout, did he just demand it? Was he important enough that others would just keep out his way a little bit? Or was it just the sheer desperation that he showed on his face that pulled him to the front of the crowd? But did that lift the crowd up even more, just because they knew that there was a situation, they knew that Jesus was likely to enter into that situation? Did that build up the hype, the drama, the scandal? But actually, I think in this story, it's this secondary, it's the B plot that is the most fascinating. Because it's simply a story of a woman touching Jesus. And on first reading, it's a violation, isn't it? Isn't it? When somebody touches us without permission, it's a violation. It's unwanted affection when you want to be left alone. It's, do I dare use the word abuse? We could go that far. But actually, it isn't in this case, is it? Is it not just desperation? And actually, I don't think it's even desperation to touch Jesus. I don't think that's what it is. I think it's desperation from the woman to see something change. She recognizes that the position that she's in, she's suffered all of these years with this mysterious bleeding, whatever it is. And she's desperate to see something change, and she reaches out, not because she needs to, not in that fandom way. This isn't rock star Jesus. But she realizes that she needs to get as close as she can, because she needs something to change within her. And the only thing, because she can't get close enough to talk to him, she knows that he's got other purposes going on. The only thing that she can do is just grab whatever she can. And she grabs, she doesn't even touch him physically, but just his cloak. But what is it that changes her? Is it a magic cloth? I don't know if you've seen any of these televangelists, but there are televangelists, American style, who will sell you a magic cloth for $50 and you will receive a blessing, and it's nonsense. It's evil, actually. But was it magic cloth? Is this some kind of... No. It's not that. It can't be that, can it? It's actually somehow, I think, the openness of her heart and the proximity of Jesus that changes her. It's just that she is so open and so ready to be changed that she reaches out and she gets close to Jesus. She doesn't even touch him. She just, I don't know whether it's a brush or a grab on Jesus' cloak, but it's close enough, and it's the Spirit just works because she's open to it. She's ready for something to be changed. But I wonder how quickly then she fears that violation. How quickly was it that Jesus stops and says, "Whoa, something happened to you." And what is that about? Why did Jesus need to call her out? Why did he? Doesn't that make it worse? Isn't she just horribly embarrassed and aware? And couldn't Jesus just have given that for her for free? Couldn't he? Well, actually, it's about the further story here, isn't it? Because here is a woman who has been bleeding, possibly intimately, for years. And that bleeding has effectively declared her unclean. She can't go into the temple in that, and she can't stop the bleeding, so therefore she can't purify herself or be purified by ritual because of that bleeding, because it won't stop. She loses access to her community. She loses access, that close access to faith in that way, because she's bleeding. She can't stop it. She can't do anything about it. She's been had that declared over her. The people would know that that was her position. However intimate this problem was, people knew, because they knew that she couldn't go. They knew that she couldn't attend. I don't know whether it was something they could see. Perhaps it was. But it was nothing that she could do. So the reason that Jesus stops her, the reason that Jesus says, stop everybody, something has happened here, it's not embarrassment. It's not to declare the violation, but actually what does Jesus want to do? But restore her. Because she's been healed, she needs that, she cries for that, but how does she then stand before, what embarrassment would that cause for her to stand in front of the priest and say, no, I can come in now? How does everybody else allow her back into society without, in a sense, violating herself, showing her, humiliating her, and say, look, I've stopped, whatever it is, wherever that bleeding comes from? And so Jesus stops the crowd. He says, what's going on? He knows what's happened. He says, your faith has healed you. Go in peace. So that everybody in that crowd, and of course they would stop, because Jesus has made a fuss. He said, something has happened here. Stop, look, this woman has been restored. Now go. Now you can go. Now that everybody has heard, now that everybody has seen, now that you've been restored, not just physically, but back to society and your family and your friends, go in peace. That's wholeness. If you'd have just taken that supernatural healing, as special as that would have been, Jesus says, that's not enough. I want you to be fully whole again. It's shalom that he restores her to. What if you were Jairus watching Jesus do this? How frustrating. My daughter's dying, and Jesus is stopping a crowd. We're on our way here. And it's just as this all happens that the word comes through. What if you're Jairus? Because we're only talking about a matter of minutes, but actually that sounds like that's all it would have taken. What if you're Jairus? Aren't you angry at Jesus at this point? Aren't you? Frustrated, at least? You might have already given up hope in terms of your daughter, but aren't you frustrated that Jesus was so close and yet not? I wonder if you would receive the words of verse 50 and be calmed. Jesus said to Jairus, "Don't be afraid. Just believe, and she will be healed." You've just heard your daughter's dead. That's not healing. If I'm Jairus, it's nothing to... What, Jesus? I'm putting myself into the story there, but what? I can see you, Jesus. I think I know what you've just done for this lady in restoring her. I can believe that because I've seen it with my own eyes, but what? Don't be afraid. Just believe, and she will be healed. Would you have the courage to believe that? Do you have the courage this morning to believe that in the face of your adversity? The household were already in mourning when they arrived. They were releasing that cry of the heart. They were wailing. I think there's something incredibly healthy about wailing, by the way. It doesn't fit in our culture. But there's some, it seems to be something incredibly therapeutic. If you ever come into another culture around a death, that there's something incredibly therapeutic about just that deep wail from the depth of somebody's soul. If you've ever seen it, I think you know it and see it. I've seen it in a number of places. It seems to be so healthy, so normal. I think it's what I feel sometimes in that situation. But actually, Jesus says, stop. Jesus says to those who mourn, stop. Because in this case, death did not intimidate him. Isn't that an incredible thing to say? That death does not intimidate Jesus. It's true. It takes just the simplest of commands and such little fuss and drama, and this undernourished girl, she needs something to eat. She returns from the slumber of death. Her spirit returns into her. I somehow made the connection between these two interwoven stories and that psalm that I read at the beginning of our service. It just reminds me that God does not sleep. God does not slumber, and that God is not dead. Isn't it the simplest of things to say? That God is awake and aware of our existence. That he is not lost to our existence. That he has not abandoned us. He's not left us to one side. That somehow he manages to pay attention to us. Even me. He's never left. Nor will he ever leave. The word that came to me for this morning was to reach out. It was just there towards the end of the week. Just reach out. And I think because of who I am and because of the music that I tend to enjoy, I go back to the song, Reach Out, brackets, I'll be there. At the beginning of this year, nothing has changed. Nothing is different from the passing of the 31st to the 1st of another. Nothing. Here is yet another day of the Lord's appointing, and yet if we choose to make a change, we're able to do so. The woman in the crowd came forward because she was desperate, because she was desperate enough to do something about that which ailed her. I think she was desperate to see change, desperate to be restored to life. And she was restored to life and society and commissioned to play a full part. But she chose to move forward. She chose to take the opportunity. She could have stayed at a great distance. She initiated the action. She reached out. And I can only encourage you this morning that if you're waiting for a miracle to come or for something to change, that my experience tells me that you may need to reach for it. The mountaintop will rarely come to you. Most of the time, you need to climb. Secondly, I wonder whether for some of you, you just need to move forward a bit in the crowd. Wherever your default position. I wonder whether some of you have been in the crowd with Jesus for a while, and you've been hanging around at the back, or you've been happy to look on from a bit of a distance because you're concerned about what you might be asked to do. Or you're concerned that you might just become a little bit stranger, that something might change within you that you're not willing to allow to change. There are lots of strange Christians in the world, by the way. Don't look at anybody at this point. But I just want to assure you that if you do reach out in that way, if you do come forward in the crowd in that way, that if you reach out, that the only risk is that you would become more like Jesus. Some things actually might need to change within you. That's, of course, always true. But the bottom line is that he made you. And he loves most of who you are. And actually only wants to get rid of the stuff that holds you back from him. But he loves you. He likes you. I think that's sometimes important to hear. The other thing, and I think this is so wound up in the story, and it's the difference between, excuse the Greek for a moment, the chronos and kairos. I think some of you just need to hear what Jesus says for Jairus and remember kairos. I'm not trying to rhyme here. It's just the way it came out. Jesus says, don't be afraid, just believe, and... And the end for you could be anything. It could be the beginning of any number of sentences that speak of you or of someone you love, someone who needs restoration to wholeness. But what Jesus doesn't say and doesn't promise is that it will immediately all be well. The story of Jairus' daughter is one of God working out his promises so that at the right and appointed time, things would change and be restored. And that's the difference between the normal passing of time, which is chronos, and which is torture for those who wait, and those who want, and those who feel they need something now. But Jesus says, don't be afraid. Just believe, and at the right time, and according to his purposes, and in his way, and according to his will of things, it will be right. All will be well, and just so. And that is kairos. That's Jesus choosing to do things for our very best, and at the right time, not according to our agenda. So today is just another day of the Lord's appointment, but that does not mean it's without purpose. And it absolutely is an opportunity. And again, I say to you, if not today, then when? Why not now? And I go back to those words that were with me over this week. Reach out. He will be there. He's waiting. He's ready for you. Let's take a moment to think, to pray, to reflect.